empiricist, or to the success that is attainable, as the pragmatist talks about, but rather it's an attempt to show what would have to be true, what are the preconditions for the intelligibility of all of our rational procedures. Well, actually, you're bringing a little bit different dimension here, but I thank you for that. Let me say two things about settleability. Some arguments for the existence of God or the Christian worldview do not settle the issue. They say we're using common rational procedures that the unbeliever understands, and we can show very likely that the Christian worldview is the one you should choose. But they can't settle it. It can't be conclusive. But what I was talking about, it's related to this issue, what I was talking about, though, is it possible to have any settled conviction in the face of skepticism? And the transcendental approach to reasoning answers the skeptic in a way that the foundationalist, you know, be they common sense, perceptual, rational, what have you, and the pragmatist, on the other hand, cannot. So, in terms of general formal considerations, Bill, transcendental reasoning is an attempt to answer skepticism that's different from the foundationalist and different from the pragmatist. So the transcendentalist is saying things can be settled. Okay. Now, when you translate this into the Christian context, and we're arguing for the Christian worldview, we're also saying, and we can settle the issue of God's existence. Yeah. Now, early on, I've got to probably move a little bit faster, but early on I said, I believe the existence of God is provable. Now, let me go back and looking at these approaches, show you by contrast what I'm getting at when I endorse a transcendental approach. I'm only going to use one. I had thought about the others as well. But let's just take what is called the cosmological argument for God's existence. This is standard fare in apologetics. Cosmological argument tries to show that from a certain concept or principle that we have about the way the world is, God must exist. And the specific concept that is used, the principle that is used in the cosmological argument, is that of causation. Every event has a cause. We all know that. Every event has a cause. Now, since we've had an experience of causes, what we'll call secondary causes, the cosmological argument says there must be a primary cause, a first cause, for this causal network or chain that we've experienced ourselves. Okay, so we all know what it is to insulate our homes and see our fuel bill go down. We see there's a causal relationship there. We all have seen what it is to plant a peach tree and then eventually see peaches grow and we harvest them and eat them. Okay, so we've all had experience of events being caused. Okay, so the event of my fuel bill going down was caused, the event of eating the peaches was caused, and on and on and on. And so there seems to be here a principle, according to this argument, that every event has a cause. Or, to put it more crudely, every object has an origin. Every event has a cause, every object has an origin. So the cosmological argument starts with empirical premises. You've all experienced causation or origination. And from these observations, generalizes that every event or object has a cause or origin, and then says, therefore, the world as a whole must have a cause or an origin. And that's what we call God. Now, is there anything wrong with this argument?
Yes.
Well, I hope all of you are just, I mean, there's so many fallacies in this argument, it's just incredible. 5 years ago there wasn't?
No, it was perfect then. Now I should probably.
Thank you for that personal testimony, Mike. Anybody else would like to give their, as I was once a natural theologian. Well, let's go back to the, just so we can pick at this a little bit for fun. Can I generalize from many observations that events have causes, that all events have causes? Do I have any right to do that? That's a fallacy, isn't it? I can't argue from some to all unless what? I assume the very thing that I'm supposed to be proving. The causation is a universal principle. But now, if causation is a universal principle, can I say that because each event has a cause, that all events together have a cause? Now, that's another logical fallacy, right? Fallacy of composition. You say, what's true of the parts is not necessarily true of the whole. And yet the cosmological argument commits that fallacy. Can I argue that what I know from my natural experience is a foundation for what must be true of the supernatural? No, this is Kant's argument, that at best the cosmological argument tells us something about a natural cause of all things. It couldn't tell us anything about a supernatural cause, or else we would have the fallacy of equivocation. Our premises would mean one thing, our conclusion would mean another when we talk about causes. So, well then, there's the child's question too, and just about any unbeliever at the university can figure this out. When the cosmological argument's given, every event has a cause, naturally we're going to ask ourselves, well then, what's the cause for the event we call God? If every object has an origin, what's God's origin? And Christians, I think, are notoriously embarrassing, you know, in the face of that kind of argument. You know, they always say, well, it's got to stop somewhere. To which Schopenhauer said, well, why shouldn't it stop at the world? If you're going to take this taxi and arbitrarily get out of the taxi, then you can choose where you get out. Okay, so the cosmological argument, though it is very popular, in fact, as Mike and others might testify, in evangelical circles, there are people who say, this is where the, you know, this is where the action is, right? Cosmological argument can be sliced and diced. So I started out by saying, I think there's an objective proof for God's existence. Cosmological argument's not going to be it, or arguments like it. I could give you examples from inductive arguments, too. You like this one about how the New Testament documents are basically reliable, and then we learn about Jesus who made certain claims, and he rose from the dead. No other theory can account for that, you know, claim that he rose from the dead, except that, in fact, he did rise from the dead. Really? That's an amazing leap to me. But if you're a believer, when you read that stuff, I think I'm probably $2 million. When I first read that stuff, and I hadn't studied philosophy and so forth, I think I was a senior in high school the first time I encountered what's called the historic argument for the resurrection. It clicked. I said, of course, that's it, that's right. Why? Well, because I had the right presuppositions. But then within the Christian worldview, it doesn't make sense to say that people would claim that Jesus rose from the dead on the swoon theory and on all these other sorts of things. But, you know, out there in the world, if you think this is an objective, you know, value-free proof from history, boy, you've got a real lesson coming to you. So, how then can we objectively prove God's existence? Let me go back to the cosmological argument and try to resurrect it for you. The cosmological argument, as it's properly used, makes the mistake of trying to be neutral in our orientation. We say, let's everybody put aside their presuppositions. Okay? Let's just reason in a neutral way. And then tries to take observational truths, which are then fallaciously generalized and pushed into the supernatural and all that, to show that God exists. And the engine in the cosmological argument, if I can put it that way, is the causal principle. So I'm going to go back and I'm going to give you a cosmological argument, but not one that says, let's put aside our presuppositions and go to our observations and then generalize and draw deductions and so forth. I am going to go to the causal principle, though. I'm going to say, let's look at that causal principle. The causal principle, to put it another way, is what we call the foundation of inductive reasoning. Inductive reasoning says that I can take instances from my experience and generalize from them either across time or ahead in time. By across time, I mean simply, if I learn certain things about crows, I should be able to generalize about all crows at that very moment. I learn something about the nature of crowness when I study individual crows. But that's an inductive generalization from particulars to the class of crows, okay? Or to the nature or property of crowness. Ahead of time, what I mean by that is I can generalize from events that I'm familiar with to what will happen in the future. So if I've dropped an apple, 10 times in the past, or I've let go of the apple and it has dropped, so I've seen the event of letting go of the apple leads to the event of it dropping, I would inductively generalize that the event of letting go of the apple 10 seconds from now will lead to the event or would be followed by the event of it dropping to the ground. Inductive generalization is the basis, then, of our causal reasoning. But can that be justified? Is it reasonable to expect that we can generalize from particular cases to either properties or to future events? Now, what if we can't? What if it's not rational to do that? This is where a lot of students drop out of the philosophy class and say, I think I'll go take some psychology instead. So who cares about the inductive principle? Well, what I'm assuming here is that you care to be rational. I know that you care about the inductive principle because you can't live without it. You can't reason without it. You can't use language without it. You can't live your life. Simple illustration that many of you have heard, we all learn when we stub our toe to try to avoid stubbing our toe next time, right? Why do it? Because we assume that if it hurt in the past, it will hurt in the future. But that, of course, that presumes a certain view of reality, a certain kind of continuity or uniformity in the world, in terms of which I can inductively generalize. So I'll go back to the cosmological argument, pick up the causal principle, and ask now, is there a reason for believing that inductive reasoning is well-grounded, that there is causation in the world? And I now address this to the unbeliever and say, now you need to use the causal principle. You need to use inductive reasoning. You're using it. Is it rational for you to do so? Let's say this unbeliever has come to me and has said, is it rational for you to be a Christian? Be prepared to give an answer to every man who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you. The guy comes to me and says, is it rational to be a Christian? My approach to him, apologetically, is to ask him, well, is it rational to use the causal principle? Is it rational to engage in inductive reasoning? He says, well, of course it is. And it's because us scientists have used the causal principle in inductive reasoning that we know that you Christians are irrational. And I say, well, wait a minute, not so fast. How do you know that it's rational to use the inductive principle? What would have to be true in order for you to use the inductive principle? Now, if you study this or if you listen to my debates and lectures that I have on this, you already know, the best in the unbelieving world openly admits that there is no justification for induction. No justification in the traditional, narrow, philosophical sense. We can't offer you some principle which itself is well-grounded, by which we could justify the inductive principle. In the end, I already told you, Quine says we use the inductive principle because we're the kinds of creatures that have survived, and the only reason we've survived is because we use it. And when Quine says that in The Web of Belief, at least he's an honest enough philosopher, I have to respect him for that, he immediately says, and that, of course, is a subtle begging of the question. I'm not quoting him, but it's words to that effect. He says something to the effect, in subtle ways, that's already assuming the inductive principle when I offer that as the rationale for the inductive principle. Okay, so now what I'm getting at is that I am going to offer a proof for the rationality of Christianity that goes something like this. Without the Christian worldview, rationality itself is unintelligible. That the methods you have been using as a scientist to argue against me as a Christian themselves reduce to subjectivism and skepticism unless you have the Christian worldview as the framework or context for using them. Here I'm not appealing to a rational deductive argument. I'm not saying I've got a clear and distinct idea of God's existence. Nor am I giving a cosmological deduction. I'm not appealing to empirical evidence. I'm not appealing even to pragmatic success, although you can rephrase the argument to look deductive, empirical, or pragmatic in various ways. I mean, if you want to be successful at the game of intellect, then this is a pragmatic argument. But I hope you can all see that though you can metaphorically talk about a transcendental argument in those ways, it's a distinct form of reasoning that is asking, what is the broader framework in terms of which we do these other things? And my Christian apologetic is to this effect, that if you don't have the Christian worldview, you're not able to reason, make sense of reasoning, or prove anything at all. Ultimately, I'm not assuming that the unbeliever is able to prove things rationally or empirically, what have you, and now I'm going to try to satisfy him by giving him enough grist for his mill. It's not that I'm going to provide the raw material now that he can use his reasoning process and prove God's existence. I'm going to say your reasoning process proves God's existence. Because if God didn't exist, you couldn't make sense out of reasoning.